is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, I'm Lana Lochteff, your hostess of Radio 314. Thanks for downloading or streaming the very first program. And thank you, Henrik, for adding this addition to your outstanding website. My first guest, Elaine Nikuana, is not only a good friend of mine, but she's an extremely talented and high-spirited artist, illustrator, and researcher of Irish folklore and mythology. Elaine is also no stranger when it comes to conspiracy and esoteric subject matters. She goes under the brush name Scrafio. I describe her artwork as fantastically dark yet enchanting and inviting. You can definitely see the influence of Irish mythology and folklore in her work. Hi, Elaine. How are you in Dublin today?
How are you, Lana? It's an absolute pleasure to be on. Gurmila Mahagut, a thousand thanks for giving me the chance to come on and speak today. So things are good in Dublin. Not too bad. A bit of rain, a bit of sunshine.
Same here.
Yeah,
maybe we can begin with your early artistic process and how that began.
Yes, the beginnings of the artistic kind of journey, as it were, from the age of three onwards, painting and just drawing and just making a mess of things around me, just painting on walls or on the ground. That was the first thing I knew I could do really well. I enjoyed it, and it was I painted before I could write, before I could tie my shoelace, before I could tell the time. You know, it was, and you know, I found school, and particularly, I could understand that there was parts that I wasn't as good at when it came, academically speaking. But painting and drawing was something that a lot of people around me had noticed that I could do. Like a lot better than most, and as well as that, I was left-handed, and you don't really know this until you're really told that that you're left-handed and you're not like of the normal majority in the class. But from a very young age, it was something that I just loved to flow myself into, and music as well, and painting and just movement, the whole kind of artistic area, it's something that just came more naturally to me. And in my teenage years, music was something that kept me going, and just expanding, getting into areas, genres of music that you wouldn't necessarily hear in the mainstream, and coming across pirate radio and coming across independent music shops and getting hold on music that was put out independently, even if it was dodgy techno, something that was there was something about it that just going out and searching for this stuff, material that was put out there by people that you wouldn't have come across normally. And I found that when it came to the artistic process, it wasn't until I was 19 that I was really aware of potential of your own kind of expression, that it's an important thing to be aware of. Because I did an art performance after I finished school, and I was pretty disillusionized by a lot of things, and it was just a very interesting moment really in my life. It was a bit of a milestone in that I putting a lot of the frustration and a lot of aggression that you've been building up over that particular time in your life when you're a teenager, you feel you're very much alone, and which is an illusion because you're not alone at all, but you are just burdened by a lot of things, and a lot of things do not make sense, and you don't know how to explain it, and you're as it's one of those things that the creating, whether it's through music, whether it's through art, whether it's through many means of dance, you are kind of getting into touch with something that it is a freedom in a sense. And
so would you say there's a sacred element involved in the artistic process?
I believe it more now than ever. And I didn't believe it in my teenage years, but I would have been aware of it even as a child. And like, to even backtrack a bit, when I was 13, I actually sold my first painting. And then again, when I was 14, and in my, from the age of 12 to up to 15, I was absolutely in love with, the landscape, the natural landscape. I fell in love with like romanticism and rural landscapes. And it was all through my mind that I was seeing these images that I wanted to put down onto paper. And most of the students I saw in my art class that I was going to, they were always painting what they saw on a photograph. Or, you know, it is important to kind of study structures, but I was totally aware of the imaginary world in my younger days, and in my teenage times I just kind of wanted to forget about it because it was seen as there was no magic in the world. You know, I was just so angry about everything. I had refused or just wanted to ignore aspects of myself that I just can't deny anymore.
Yeah, Irish folklore is full of mystical creatures and supernatural people.
Absolutely. I mean, like when I was 8 years of age, that was the real first kind of awakening of stories, of accounts. Like the Grimm brothers was nice. I loved hearing the stories about Cinderella and you know, Red Riding Hood. But when I heard of the legends, like the mythology cycle, particularly of Ireland, like the Tuatha Dé Danann and just certain interchangeable figures that, you know, reincarnation was clear in these stories. You know, the fairy beings, the good people, the Dí Ní Mhuir, like they existed in all realms, you know, in the world. And, you know, when I started to study actually these kind of entities, these beings, the elemental kingdom, even as a subject itself, you know, there are a lot of truths that come out, particularly even when you look back on the history of the world, the story of humanity, you know. And, you know, when I first heard these stories, it was on tape, it was on a little audio tape, like a nighttime stories, which wouldn't be, you know, exactly the best thing when you're 8 to hear when you're going to bed. But I loved hearing them by the spoken mouth. And you know, it's more natural to me to absorb information by hearing it by the ear or hearing it in the moment, the ephemeral. And, you know, Baelagus is the Irish word for folklore. And folklore, the word itself is a bit loaded because it can be kind of condescending, like the lore of the folk, the kind of the quaint folk that we don't take seriously. But Baelagus, being Baal, the mouth, and Aegis, like of knowledge of the mouth, you know, this oral tradition that would continue to be passed on from generation to generation. And you see that everywhere around the world. You know, it's not just, there are certain fragments that still could contain it. But
I think Ireland's good at keeping the folklore alive too, even through the Irish drinking songs, whereas other cultures it's kind of dying off.
What's interesting about the ballads and the songs, music was what all people, that's all they had, because they didn't have anything else. They had nothing else to kind of get what they wanted to say out, you know, because most couldn't read or write. They weren't entitled to what we all take now for granted, you know, and they could see truths. They that's why they were, the enforcement was so strong in them, because their spirit couldn't be broken. But we are all broken now because we don't believe in half the things that we should know about. And we're more intoxicated now than ever. You know, it's really interesting how, you know, being, at least be aware of these things, you know, without taking them for granted. And I find that when in my teenage years, when I didn't, I was just, you go into a dark zone, and it's great when you can kind of look back and go, well, you needed to go through that to kind of get back on the other side. It was kind of like going into Hades for a long time and then kind of resurfacing again. But it was true. It's always through these aspects of music and through just visual images that are a language in themselves, and they're speaking to you in a way that there's something that you just get. It's like, it's really intelligent, you know, and I fell upon these illustration artists, like the golden age of illustration would have been the beginnings of the 20th century. And I had the artist like of Ivan Biliban, who is this Russian artist who illustrated the Slavic folk tales of the people. And we had an artist called Harry Clark, who was a stained glass artist, but his illustration work he did for Edgar Allan Poe and Hans Christian Andersen. And, you know, these are grown adults who are getting into areas that are vitally important, and in that they're reminding you of aspects that we were coming to an age that we were beginning to forget again, you know.
What aspects are these that we're forgetting right now?
Yeah, it's what Carl Jung even speaks about. He states that the fantasy is a fact. It's a form of moving energy. It becomes a reality. And I mean, mythologies being a series of images that formulate the life of the archetype, you know, you need to be conscious of the aspect of this existence, because this archetype that, you know, we see in these mythologies that we may relate to, that archetype indeed could be your higher self. I know I'm being kind of vague on that, but it does come out that, you know, when you delve into these things, the richness emerges. And what I remembered finally when I came in contact with these stories again, with these mythologies, with the help of music, particularly metal music.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. You're a big fan. What's the draw there?
What's the draw of metal? Well, I mean, if you think of it, metal is, again, it's influenced by blues and it's influenced by folk music. And that's the music of the people. It's their one way to get what they want to say. And metal is a massive genre. It's got so many areas in it that branches out, and not everything in it that you might like. But what I do appreciate within metal is that it is very honest. It's quite confrontational. Same with punk as well. It's quite confrontational and it's aggravated. But, you know, anger needs a voice. It needs a song.
I'd rather listen to that than, you know, Jay-Z or Beyonce.
Yeah, that's fake. It's total bubblegum fakeness. And the untruthfulness does a lot of harm, you know. Mm-hmm. The truth is a hard pill to swallow, but at least you know what it is and what it stands for. And it's not. I don't think metal was meant to be nice, and I don't think it's meant to be liked by people. You either get it or you don't. And I found what was interesting about metal, the metal gigs in general, they were actually quite welcoming. If, you know, nobody actually cares who you are or, you know, what clique and scene you're in. I've always observed all the types of music circles, because in my teenage years I was heavily into electronica, and even when I came upon Black Sabbath, and it was only when I wanted to start doing drumming, just the performance itself was a great release. You know, I had to check these bands out again, and hearing the likes of Bill Ward drumming in Black Sabbath had this jazzy blues element to it, and then Motorhead, Phil, Filthy Animal, you know, there was just such a great, how do you explain it? Just the thrill of it, you know?
Is it about music? Why is it so powerful, powerful enough to get people to transform and even awaken?
I mean, again, it's you know, either it's echoing memories back to you, or it kind of hits you. It hits you in a way that it's triggering things, actually. That's what I notice. And when I am in the process, the creative process, within those hours, those liminal hours, past midnight, before sunrise, you know, or just about when everyone's getting up to work, that's when I'll probably drop a bit. But it's kind of a time that, that's, I think, when the creative process is really alive. And music is just, it gets you into that trance, actually. For me, it's a quick way to get into that trance element. Now, I don't use any psychoactive kind of influences, and I have no problem with them, but I just don't use them, because in my own situation, I wouldn't be taking anything in my environment that I'm in. It just would be unsuitable.
So music's, you know, kind of your tool. It's a meditational tool to kind of warm you up, to open you up maybe to another realm, and then you can start painting.
Yeah, it really, really does. For me, anyway, I don't know what it else is like for anyone else, but it is a very personal thing. It's actually quite sacred. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain it sometimes, because it is a very, you can't really put a price to it. And this is where I have always been kind of at a tug of war with the whole art world kind of view. What is art? I find it a very excluding kind of world, and that I would never want to be a part of, actually, because it doesn't actually explain the real point of it, you know. It gets a bit too vague for my liking.
It's also a fake kind of pain and darkness, you know.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I believe that you should be able to release what's building up in you, definitely on the canvas. But, you know, it's a creative process that you're using an energy that productively, really. Whereas the art world, they're gaining wealth of people who are talented, you know, and they're not actually doing the artwork themselves. They're parasites, actually, living off creative people who are not of that business mind likeness. You know, you could be a great artist and a good businessman as well, but I find that it kind of, you know, it's a tough one to kind of balance, I find, because this is priceless. You know, this is not something you could just, you can't equate it with money. You know, it's an abundance of wealth of imagination, you know, mm-hmm. and the imaginary realm is something you can tap into if you respect it fully. And it's something that will definitely open up to you if you agree to co-create with it, you know, and it's more than happy to do that. There's no mystery behind it. I think it's the integrity is what really has to be looked at. And, you know, this intelligence knows this. It can see a mile shot, you know, if you have the integrity or not. And, I mean, even looking at Carl Jung, particularly his Red Book, and it is a really fascinating, kind of his own journey, as it were, through the creative processes. And, you know, it's, he himself, you can gain so much from just wanting to just go out there and do things that you want to do, that you feel that you're just something that's inspiring, pushing you to do something that it will make you something. You actually get rewarded. It's like a never ending abundance mm-hmm. of inspiration that's coming out of you. Like for yourselves, like the whole radio shows. I mean, it comes out of just wanting to do it, and it will come, and it will come, and it will never cease, really, because there's an endless kind of rotation, mm-hmm. you know, coming at you, because you actually are honest about it. There's a drive that you're pushing to kind of get answers that you're only right to know about.
And
you know?
I think the spirit recognizes that, and then that's where it's going to go flow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just looking at individuals, Steiner and Carl Jung, like what they achieved and what they managed to just do for this, because they just felt it was right to do. I mean, Carl Jung built his own homestead in Balingen in Switzerland, and, you know, he called it his maternal hearth, you know, and home is where the hearth is, and your own body is as a home as well, that you have to, you know, you're building it for, you know, for years. Make it a That's good right. home for yourself.
And some people even argue you're building your soul.
yeah. I mean, there's parts of the body that, I mean, the temple in your own head, you know, if you think of it, there's some really interesting reflections that did exist, but we kind of forgotten about, actually. I mean, even when you look at medieval kind of manuscripts and what they thought about life and the human body. And a really interesting insight I heard was regarding the memory box that's stored in the back of your neck. And it's apparently when that moment when you want to think of something or trying to remember something, so you lift your head up. And that's the moment when you lift the lid of the box up, you know. And there's a point in, it is a power point as well at that back of your neck. It's, but, you know, we don't look at the body like that, you know, today, particularly in science.
So do you think at one point in history in the past that we were supernatural and more magical, and that some of these even magical beings could have existed, that maybe folklore is more than just storytelling, you know, not just fictional stories?
Yeah, I mean, there's always truth in a rumor, you know, and I find that it's not that long ago, and I still think there are people who are aware of it, that these supernatural beings, they are very much alive, but, you know, we've created an environment now. We're creating cities that you couldn't imagine them to be. They wouldn't be around there.
They're not going to be hanging out in a Soviet gulag, I'll tell you that.
No, they're not.
None of those high-rise apartment buildings.
Yeah, they're getting the hell out of there. You know, they're going, what the, you know, what is this? They're within nature itself. And I mean, coming across information on where they live, where they exist, and it's, you know, we have all sorts of names for them, and it's in the Scandinavian traditions as well, and in Icelandic kind of accounts, and in the Irish and the Welsh and the Scottish and in English, you know, you have them everywhere, you know, and you have like the hill folk, the wee folk of the sea, you know, and it's, you know, you have them existing in areas, pockets of you know, you have them, the fairy host of the sky, Slua seeing the spare, you know, mm-hmm. and the wee gentry of the sea, Usla Bioga Nafarga, you know, they exist in all these areas. And also you can't, you know, there was a reluctance to it from what the material that I've been looking at, a reluctance to annoy them, you know, because you were cohabiting the landscape with them. So you better not get on their heels, because they're gonna put you in your place. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of accounts of abductions, particularly, and changelings. And it kind of makes you wonder about the case of people would view the abductions today would be more of the, you know, in the alternative area of the alien abductions as such. But, mm-hmm. you know, there was a genuine belief of fairy abductions and how to prevent that, you know. And
really? I had no idea.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. But I mean, another thing that kind of like what fascinates me is their awareness of your integrity. If you are into music, particularly, now there's lots of musicians who genuinely believe that they received their gift of music from the fairy people, the good people, you know. Mm. And that's what always fascinates me most, because some of these individuals were incredible musicians, you know. Particularly in the traditional area in Ireland, there is one Ilan Piper from Donegal called Turlough MacSweeney. Now, he said himself he wasn't a very good piper from the beginning, but he came from a family of, like, very, you know, excellent pipers. And he said himself one time, he was actually living up in Gweedore, and Gweedore is where Clannad and Enya are from, and that's in itself is an amazing landscape. It's Donegal is kind of like the most northwest, you know, of Ireland, and it is an incredible place, it really. And it's not as it's not bombarded by tourism as much as Kerry would be. And Kerry, the south of Ireland, is really another area that's quite unusual. And he says that one night he went up to the it would be said a fairy fort. An old stone fort. And he went up, it could have been a mound fort now or a stone fort, but he went up in the middle of the night and he had his pipes with him. And he addressed, as he said, the fairy, the king of the fairies in that fort. Mm-hmm. And before he even spoke out, he had just thought it, he started to hear this music, kind of, and he would just went white in the face and he legged it, you know, and he just ran and he ran through the fields and his pipes actually fell halfway. So as he was running, parts of his pipes were coming away, and he was only left with, I don't know, I think it was just it wasn't the chanter, which would have been the actual, you know, the stick, the flute, the voice of the pipes, but it would, mm-hmm. I think it was the bellows, that was all he had around him. And he was absolutely terrified. I wasn't aware of what he had actually asked for. You know, be careful what you wish for, you know, be aware of your thoughts carry more than you realise. They carry more gravity. And he went back the following day and travelled back that journey up to the fort, like a procession back up there. And he, to his own like amazement, as soon as he started to play, the chanter was just alive. And he became, the gift of music had been given to him, you know. And that was his account of how he gained his gift. And he was seen as quite a... how do you say, quite of a distant man, you know, because he had his own kind of understanding of how he got his own gift, but he was fully aware of these things. And even at his time, he was seen as a bit odd. But what I find most fascinating about him was that he wasn't at all intimidated by the local priest, you know, whereas most people would have been genuflecting and out of fear, they would be kind of, you know, they wouldn't ever challenge such a man of high power status. But this piper, you know, he had this, as you could say, a freedom, or kind of, he knew the kind of natural laws, as it were. You know, he just, mm-hmm. he understood that we're all on an equal level here, you know. And no matter what, you know, high king you are, you know, we're all of the same spiritual kind of integrity, really. You know, no one is above the next. Some of us, or whatever beings, might have evolved more, but they're not any better.
Well, we're all on Earth right now, so yeah, it's an equal playing field, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, it's. I think when it comes to information, or those who gather the information for themselves and don't disseminate it freely, because they know that it would free people. They just keep it for themselves to kind of feel that they are of more importance, or they just, it's, that's a, it, that will actually fall back, because it just doesn't work like that, you know, because freedom, knowledge is for everyone. It's not just for the few minority. Right. And, you know, when, like, even looking back on, regarding, Terry Broadman, when he was speaking about, when he did a talk back in London for the, was it the AV2 seminar, wasn't it?
I think it was too, yeah.
And he brought up one individual, a man called Bertrand Russell, and his book on the impact of science on the society in 1953. And, you know, it was really interesting that Terry brought this man up, because he was highlighting this, the kind of control, or deciding to how to control a society, and how a society should be a kind of geared towards their goal, their aim goal. And what blew my mind was when, out of the three ways of securing a society, whether it be birth control, infanticide, wars, but the third being that general misery would have been an ingredient to control this, the perfect society.
That's great. They wished.
Yeah, and it was, except for a powerful minority, they would never be touched by this misery. But creating a world so miserable that beings would not want to wish to return, you know, and this concerns what has been manifested, you know, and how the power of thought, really, and how just that thought can manifest more than you realize if you have all the effort and the realization, you know, that thought is very powerful. And even if all are miserable, all believe themselves to be happy because the government will tell them that that is so. And the government being the governors of the mind, you know. And it's this kind of withholding an awareness for people of their own divinity, their own divine greatness. And it's, you can tap into this with the artistic kind of expressions, you know.
And I think you do. It seems like individual sovereignty is a major point with you. I mean, I kind of feel that in your art. Am I wrong? Because some of your characters kind of feel like they're screaming, you know, set me free.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it definitely comes through the music as well, because it's if it's for the band that they wish, the main ingredient, they like the artwork and I like their music, that has to work. And if I feel that they are honest, but you know, you're given a few themes and that's all, you just don't know really the full picture what you're going
to
get.
And just to be clear, you designed some logos and CD covers for bands.
Yeah, it's mostly, they'll ask me for a design for an album cover, and hopefully it's generally a vinyl release, because I love vinyl sleeves. And, I mean, again, I forgot to mention, like, metal or rock, you know, or prog rock in the 70s and late 60s, 70s, the incredible kind of psychedelic, you know, images that were just being spewed out onto these sleeves, you know, and just never ending kind of creative of stew, you know, that was stirring. And I mean, from the Thin Lizzy covers that were mostly done by Jim Fitzpatrick, and he himself is known for his interest in the mythology cycles of Ireland, but other artists such as Frank Frazetta, incredible artist, and of course a lot of his work was seen on Molly Hatchet, but you know, it's he was another fascinating individual. And Michael Whelan, that designed did a lot of sci-fi designs. When it comes to metal bands, metal artwork on sleeve albums, the vinyl sleeves, I mean, and the bands that most inspired me, again, going back to the mythologies, Manila Road, particularly, and Ciarán Ón Gol. And Manila Road used Jim Fitzpatrick's artworks, but even at that, they really explored all areas of like Arthurian legends and such. And this is a you know, a metal band from Kansas, you know, so they were really deep into stuff that, but it's a kind of an underground cult following that you kind of can't not but appraise the effort and the labor of love. And again, a lot of these bands, it's a labor of love. These guys are not rich guys, and that's not what they aim for. It keeps them sane. you know. And Ciarán an Gall, heavily influenced by Tolkien, but they also loved their Thin Lizzy. And they had this kind of, they used Michael Whelan's artworks, which Michael Whelan had done for Michael Moorcock, you know, the Elric material. And sci-fi definitely intermingles with the fantasy and that metal loves to kind of rant on about.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, as metal is so massive, it's so broad. You have genres that are completely unlike each other, and yet it's under one heading. And it's, but it, like, as I was telling you, it is a very honest type of music. And the mainstream metal is just crap, and everyone knows that.
Yes,
and
no it one, is.
That's the stuff that does get aired sometimes. And it's not, even the mainstream metal festivals, I would kind of shy away from big time. It's always the smaller underground gigs. You know, underground as well, you're always going to get a bit of clicks involved. But to be honest with you, it's, I've always really enjoyed some of the bands I've been lucky enough to see that I would have never thought I would have seen. But Black Sabbath as well did some really interesting album sleeves. And one of their artists, Drew Struzan, who did Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. And Drew Struzan did the artwork for Blade Runner. And he also did the artwork for Back to the Future, you know. So you're getting individuals that are actively involved, you know, in some of the film posters that were mainstream and were mega blockbusters. And it's funny how sometimes these minglings kind of intertwine. Like, but it's the again, it goes back and forth, and some of the lesser well known doom metal, heavy. Rock, essentially, it's at a very slow pace. That's influenced a lot by Black Sabbath. Some of the artwork that they would have chosen, that was the key for me to find out more interesting artists. And these were the forgotten, dead artists that are now coming, are getting more praise now. But these were the guys from the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the golden age of illustration, when you really saw this. Then they were delving into all these legends and myths and acknowledging them. And, you know, again, it's coming into this when the turn of the last century, there really was a realization of this heavy materialism that was taking over. And you could see that there were those who were, well, the cult circles definitely were aware of this as well, you know. But, I mean, it's something that you kind of have to, you know, you question this mass materialism it really has stripped the spiritual endeavor, you know. And Rudolf Steiner was again ahead of so much from the time that he was even talking about this. And as Terry Boardman had pointed out, one of these lectures that Rudolf Steiner had done that were recorded, and Steiner said the aim of mass materialism and this media control as well, which is such a hypnotic thing, it's hypnotizing everyone. The aim to send a wave of materialism over the earth and make the physical plane the only valid one. A spiritual world is to be recognized only in terms of what the physical plane has to offer, you know. So you're kind of, it's this dismissiveness that you see a lot with the secularized material.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, you know,
and it's getting much worse.
It is. It absolutely is. And I was born in 1984, and already that year rings, you know, kind of can send shivers down one's back. But this freedom that the imagination that can get that's unlocked when you start delving into music that and artwork that hasn't really been broadcasted. I always love finding individuals who are not well known for some of their incredible works, you know.
Well, usually the incredible artists won't be well known.
Yeah, that's right. It's like you get the impression that there's someone pushing particular artists above others always. And I mean, you just want something that is just that speaks to you personally. And it's always a personal thing. You know, you shouldn't have to be like everyone else. And this is the biggest problem with standardization and regulation. You're meant to be like everyone else, but you're not. You know, I mean, we're all connected in a way, but you have to have your own freedom of expressing your own personality. That's the richness of creation. You're meant to co-create with this creation, you know, mm-hmm. and be able to express yourself to the fullest way, the potential of it. And standardization, averaging things, doesn't include your own distinctness.
Well, that's why the current school systems also don't encourage more artistic classes. They don't want you to be working that part of your brain, because you might wake up and say, what am I doing here?
Yeah, exactly. This is a joke. This doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, 13 years, 14 years in the education system, and I didn't gain anything from it. I mean, I wasn't a good writer, and I'm still a bit wobbly, but I mean, I should have been an apprentice or something, you know, for those 13 years. I would have gained something. And I didn't do well in art class in school at all.
Well, that's no surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I just was very bad at being told what to do. Like, I was very quiet, you know, I rarely spoke out. In fact, I rarely spoke at all. And I was just daydreaming a lot as well. I never got good grades. I was always in the special maths, the special English classes, you know. He's one of those. And also, your own self-worth was also stood on. It was like a big boot on you, actually.
It's like all kids are supposed to learn every single subject matter instead of just honing in on their one specific talent and becoming an expert in that.
Yeah. What you're good at. Do what you're good at. I naturally had to kind of go towards what I was good at, because I wasn't the sharpest in other areas. And the judgment that you get is kind of like, you're always going to be seen as a bit odd or strange if you are an artist, because you're just speaking a different language to the other people, you know? Mm-hmm. And you will come, and this is the amazing thing, you will come across people who actually get it, you know, who actually understand where you're coming from. And it kind of reaffirms to you, my God, you're not alone at all.
And isn't it probably you find it's mostly more intuitive people that you can read on that level, because it's beyond language. It's a whole other kind of communication.
It absolutely is, Lana. I mean, the fact that I've gone to certain countries and just turning around chatting to someone and them just saying something that it continues a conversation and opening up a whole, you know, area of discourse. This material that we're talking about now, that'd be the stuff that they'd want to kind of speak out about as well. What they've always been questioning. There exists definitely a timelessness in the creative expression, when you're in that creative process, whether it is through art, whether it's through music. And there are times when you do get a mental block, you do get an artistic block, a writer's block, and you don't know where you're gonna go. You have a deadline, and deadlines are a pain in the neck, because it doesn't work like that. You know, you either get that inspiration, that muse comes when you least expect, but when you got it, you're on a flow, mm-hmm. a quick flow. But you can't calculate when you're gonna get inspired.
Yeah, is that? Why not?
it's a funny one. It's either you can tap in quicker than you can. I mean, there are influences that can definitely get you in tune fast, but I think it could be tide, when the tide comes in or when it's out. You just have to, I to be honest with you, it's still a bit of a mystery to me, you know. But it's easier to kind of settle into that creative process in after midnight, and it really kicks in at around 1:30.
Because everyone else is kind of quieting down. Maybe their astral bodies aren't so busy. So it's like, yes, I get some space, you know.
There's no distractions that are caving in on you. You know, you're not getting, it's hard to have a disciplined concentration span in the world that we're living now, because there's so many things all on at once. I kind of do envy some of the people from way back who didn't have these distractions that we're being bombarded with now, you know?
Like what kind of distractions?
Definitely, I don't watch television, but you're definitely, the television's always on somehow in the background. Mm-hmm. Just the whole setup, our whole environment where you're living, you know, we don't have pure quietness. You know, you can barely see the stars sometimes. You know, it's only when you get out into the countryside that you realize the your environment really makes up, can really shift you into a different kind of mode. And it is important to get out now and again to kind of get yourself out of this routine that we're all stuck in. And it's tough because it is sometimes how you make your living. But there's a lot more going on, and we are definitely being distracted. This is the thing with the whole materials and the material world. We're being sidetracked a lot because, you know, from getting to the answers that we need to get to in life, you know, because you do have a purpose and you agreed to do certain things clearly because you wouldn't be here otherwise. And there's this kind of over dismissiveness. Oh, we're just these things. We're just here and we'll be gone before we know it. But I mean, it is precious time that's given to you. It is something you have to, I don't know, start getting an inner awareness. And there's so many challenges thrown at you, but I think people are more able for it than they realize. I mean, again, it goes back to the music being and the artwork as kind of reminders, kind of making you stand back and looking at this whole picture, and also what is inevitable, your health when or awful tragedies that happen. Time will stop for a few minutes, and you just wonder what is going on, what is this all about, you know. And what really is happening here? And do you have any part in this whole drama?
Some of your art can get dark and spooky. So what is the darkness in your art saying? Where does that come from?
It's quite dark, but beautiful. That's what a few people have said to me. There's something very dark but beautiful. And I suppose what's really coming out in the artwork, and again, it's in communication with the music, the mood that I'm getting off the music. You know, what's in the dark is generally what's overshadowed and probably what's being ignored, you know, what people are walking away from and what people are not addressing. And whatever way it's manifesting to whatever figure personality, I suppose it's making a stand in a way to kind of maybe remind some people or someone that there's something else to maybe look at a bit more closely. I mean, I know I'm being a bit vague, but I mean, you know, it's what's in the shadows is not necessarily evil.
No, of course not. It could also be unrealized potentials of yourself.
That's true. Or hidden truths always. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of that. And, you know, cellular memories, I wouldn't be surprised if that's coming through. But I mean, if you're gaining kind of channeling in, like there's all sorts of types of channeling. And I would be kind of wary of sharing my body with a separate entity. I wouldn't be up for that. But I mean, you are, again, at those liminal hours, midnight onwards, that is the time of the supernatural, as it were. And you know what we would know, particularly of the good people, the fairy people, that is their time to kind of be out and about. Trying to reflect back on the creative process and how you get into that groove of creating. I mean, you have to also look at other examples, other people who are caught in this, not necessarily caught, but kind of communicate with this kind of this group, this flow. And I mean, Joseph Campbell explains that, you know, he has two ways of writing, and one way is a very programmed way where he knows exactly what he's going to write, and you know, that's great, grand standard stuff. But as he would say, the wonderful thing is when he gets a certain beam that hits that level of mythic inspiration, mm-hmm. and from there, he knows about three words ahead of what he's going to say, and when he's writing, it's like he knows he's on a groove, and
it's
it feels like a
prophetic thing happening there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this wonderful wave. He's riding a wonderful wave, and he's flowing with it. And this is the thing that the control systems they keep kicking themselves in the gut on, because you can't control creation. Creation agreed for its own freedom to be able to be limitless in its expression. And within responsibility, of course, because you just can't do what you want to do. I mean, it has consequences. Your actions always have consequences, mm-hmm. what you do. But there is a lovingness in that creation and to co-create with that ability. But control systems, you know, they have no idea. And they're also the most boring, you know, they're so stunted.
Yeah, and I get pretty pissed because I didn't co-create this current reality.
Yeah.
Where's my contribution?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, again, going back to what Terry Boardman had pointed out regarding Bertrand Russell, this how to make the ideal society for themselves, how they would like us to be built for their long-term goals, you know, their service for something else, which its aim, its definite aim, which is kind of, it's a bit arrogant, incredibly arrogant, but also missing the whole point of creation and what the purpose of it is. You know, it's, you can't control people. I mean, you know, we have been, but I mean, it will fall back on itself somehow, because that's not the point of this whole existence. And we're caught in you could say a prison planet in a way. But there are ways of kind of going around it, I feel. And, you know, you do have to be aware, you are open to a lot of influences and elements, and you have to be aware of certain things that can trigger you. And within the whole inspiration domain, you know, there are good and bad sides always. You just have to go with your inner instinct. And there was a really important point I remember Jordan Maxwell referring to. When it comes to words, words can have so many meanings, just one word alone. When he spoke about gut, being the word for God in Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
But G-U-T-H is voice in Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gut is your gut instinct, but gut is also your voice. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to listen to that. You have to be, your body is telling you a lot of things, and we're all been kind of conditioned to not listen to our own body.
You were disattached from ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
I partly blame that on a lot of the chemicals we put on our body and eat. Things we breathe in the air.
Yeah, it's this whole kind of kind of controlling aspects of one, you know, kind of leveling a person out, you know, not making them too passionate or too, you know, just kind of droning them out a bit so that they'll be enough to get enough work done, but not enough to kind of really have the energy to kind of start really checking the stuff out. Because you know, it's mad, because everyone's too busy, they're too occupied. And I mean, when the curtain fell for me and I was totally blown away about potential or obvious things that have been going on for a long time, and you know, a lot of people, friends of mine, had just a few people just said, Elaine, I'm too busy, I've got too many things on my plate at the moment. But I'm like, yeah, but can you not just pay attention to this, just consider this, or look at this, maybe just reflect on this for a while, because things don't seem to be making any sense. You know, we're only here for a very short time, and you know, at the age of 40, if you've made up your mind already about what life's about, you're missing a huge chunk of what possibly it is more than what you think.
That's right.
Before your eyes. And I mean, as I say, 80 to 90 years of age is very young. It's not that old, you know. It's not even, as I said, the twinkling in the eye of a star, you know. It's a very young time to be here, a very short time to be here to kind of figure out everything. And we are accelerating with age faster than you could believe. And I think, I don't even think we're living longer than they said that we would live for, because everyone's picking up so many very odd diseases are kind of being formed and shaped in all sorts of ways.
We're mutating.
Yeah, you know, and I think, again, going back again, the real genuine importance of just paying attention to what people looked, the way people viewed life, and how the mythologies came around that. And I mean, it's always the material you never hear that I always want to hear more about. And you know, when it regards to traditional music of the people, you know, that they played, you know, fairy music is one signal of the very profound impact it had on human beings. And I am really fascinated about how the supernatural kind of gives, it's kind of communicates to ordinary people when they want to listen to it. and you'll hear it without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, there's artists, there's one Scottish artist called John Duncan, and he genuinely believed he heard fairy music, you know, within his ears. And some of the, again, the musicians that I absolutely admire, they acknowledge this, you know. They're not ruling it out. Some people just can't explain it. Other people are adamant that they've seen certain elemental beings.
So does that mean that we never create anything original? Are we pulling something from somewhere else all the time?
I think within your own eyes, it's unique, you know, and it's coming from yourself. But I definitely do think that there's a consciousness that has always been there anyway. And, you know, it's massive. It's absolutely boundless, you know. You know, it's truly unique. I mean, it's up to you to create that truly uniqueness through your own eyes, I suppose, and to gather the inspiration and the influences that are offered to you on a massive plate, you know, that we keep chucking away, you know. We're just turning our back onto it because, you know, we just, I don't know, want to watch Big Brother or something, you know. Mm-hmm. It's insane. It's truly unique. I think it's a yes and a no at the same time, you know. It's a hard one to kind of answer.
So are there any Irish pre-Christian traditions that really speak to you?
I suppose pre-Christian traditions. Well, I mean, the awareness of holy wells, which became holy wells, but the acknowledgement of certain springs being sacred and that people would visit them, and that the water itself had purifying qualities, and that the plants that surrounded these lakes and wells were also of medicinal goodness, you know. That's something that it still continued, but I mean, again, weed killers, you know, we've lost a lot of natural plants because of weed killers. And biodynamic farming is also a very interesting area that I would love to kind of pursue more. But if you look at the whole GM seeds, the GM crops, you can be totally assured that there's nothing in those that would, I mean, that's almost like killing off the natural kind of...
They alter organs inside of cows and pigs.
Yeah, it's... I mean, when you start messing with the... When you start messing with the natural beings, you know, I don't know if it's the outcome's going to be particularly healthy. And we are going through this... It's a bizarre machine kind of progression, isn't it? I mean, we're just, again, this labour... force that has to do stuff that I don't get it. I really just don't get it, because we're not machines, and yet we're kind of almost conditioned that we should be, and we have to be improved and updated all the time. It's like as if we're just not good enough, you know. You have to get better, because what we've been born with is absolutely incredible. What we have, our whole anatomy, is actually a really fascinating thing.
We're just not utilizing the entire machine.
Yeah, it's like we're being compared to artificial intelligence. That just doesn't have the spiritual link that we have, and that's the thing about materialism. It wants to disassociate the human being from its spiritual and soul, you know, aspects, you know, and the higher self that you have, that link, that your own connection that you have to your own higher consciousness. And I don't know if machines have that link. And you know, it's funny how that's what we're gearing towards, you know, because you break away then from that whole control paradigm, you know, that whole, it would break away their whole, what they want to manifest. It would crumble so fast, because you realize it's just a pathetic attempt to, and it has, there's been many hijacks, but I mean, you know, you should be able to see through that when you realize the greatness that you bestow, you know. And everyone has this. Everything has this. And it is actually really appalling how we've even allowed the media, people work within the media and are feeding off each other, you know, in this really weird control way. I mean, regarding the kind of flirtatious use of occult symbolism, distorted symbols particularly, which really a symbol is coded information that is speaking to your consciousness, you know, and because you are, something is tapping into you. And if it is distorted, it's basically an untruth that's hitting you on a level that, you know, you genuinely should expect things to be truthful, you know, if they are in that form. You know, it's a lethal kind of sorcery in a way. And again, you just have to try not to be naive again of these things. There's lots of mysteries, but I don't think everything should be a mystery. I genuinely think this information should be free to you to just take a filter as you should, just listen to it and take from it what you think is right, you know, not to believe everything that you're told, but to be open-minded as much as you possibly can, you know.
So do you think a lot of these advertising companies who use some of these occult symbols, do you think they know what they're doing, or is it just kind of trendy?
I think they do and they don't. It's, I mean, at the core elements of it, I do genuinely believe they know what they're using. And also the color frequencies. I mean, color is an incredible way to kind of get at people. And you are tapping into even different realm energies with certain colors, you know, red being very more mental, lower chakra area. And if you have all these incredible, you know, violets and turquoises and all these incredible azurites, all these really very, you know, that they're speaking at you, you know, they're really drawing you in. And that's purposely done without a shadow of a doubt. You just have to become more fluently aware of it, and why not? Because it's so interesting, you know. And even if you want to create beautiful, really inspiring, incredible pieces of work, you have to know these things. And I'm still only learning a tiny bits of it. I mean, the colors that I was always using, it's always of quite an earthy kind of texture. But I'm trying more and more to kind of expand the color spectrum that I have been using before. When I was at my most miserable stage, Lana, in my teens, I think I just used lots of black, you know.
Everyone hates that period.
Yeah, black is a great color. Well, it definitely gets the message straight to you. But you can only do so much of it, and sometimes you just tire. If you tire, you have to move on a bit, that's just how it should be. It should naturally just flow on to the next thing, instead of feeling, oh, I just have to use this color, you know, I'll be taken more seriously, or, you know, it's kind of you're stuck in a rut. But I mean, I even within the bands, how they present the album, the design, I mean, they, you know, you have to always be trying to search for more things that speak to you. And of course, there is a style that goes with it as well. And you see with the black metal bands, it's kind of more of a primal, kind of a crusty rawness. It's always black and white. It's always this kind of crispiness to it. And frostbitten. Frostbitten is exactly the type of landscape that they want. And death metal, of course, is total gory. And it's
demons raping angels kind of thing.
Yeah, it's quite anatomical, and lots of putrefaction and stenching going on. But I mean, it's still addressing things that are not particularly nice, but yeah, it is what it is. And it's actually, again, it's very honest, and I do respect that. It is at least saying what it is, you know, instead of wrapping it up in something that it's not. There's a reason death metal, it is actually massively popular. But you'll never hear death metal put on your mainstream radio, you know? That's the last thing.
It might wake people up, get them in touch with their anger for the world.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's really funny when you look at some of the bands that become really popular mainstream, like become mainstream popular metal bands. They're, you know, their earlier stuff before they really had been kind of, taken in under the wing of these big labels. The earlier stuff was always way better. They actually loved doing what they were doing. And, you know, this goes again to Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath, I love most of Black Sabbath's material, but their earlier stuff particularly. And they were young lads who just wanted to play rock and roll, heavy rock and roll. And you know, anyone on that era particularly, it's just this incredible flooding of just ideas just going around and people just wanting to do music that they could do finally, you know. And the saddest thing with this whole reunion that was to take place between all the Black Sabbath members, that it totally fell apart. And a lot of through, like, unfortunately, it's money that really is the kind of curse through it all. And that kind of, a lot of bitterness is now just there. And of course, the we all, quite a few, myself and a few friends, were aiming to go, and of course that didn't happen. And we still hoped that such a thing would happen, the reunion. But you know, you look back on footage and you see that they were young, and they were free in their music, and now they've got that success. But it's almost,
they also have lost arthritis now, I think, right?
Yeah, it's really stiff, and really, it's almost, it's just a shame. That the point of it wasn't about, listen, abundance should be given to everyone. You know, money is just seems to be the thing that everyone, it's what works in the economy. It used to be cattle in Ireland for hundreds of years. And, you know, when one thing is, when it's decided this is the thing that we can get what we want with, I mean, it gets out of control, you know. And I think, when you're creating with music, when you are creating these things, it's not, you can't put a price on it, and it's a very hard thing actually to kind of.
No, but at the same time, you have to eat if you want to keep creating.
You do, but I think it should be that it shouldn't be a case of what we have around us. I mean, it's self. Regenerative, you know, I can't pronounce that word right, but it's generating itself all the time. And I mean, I don't think you know, it really is a tough one to even look. Things are not fair, and it's not a fair system where we're living, and we have to work every day just to get by, you know. And none of it makes any sense, because the people who are in the places, the top jobs that there are, don't deserve to be there. And also, they are the most bloody boring people I've ever come across as well. When you hear them speaking, they're drivelly, they're dithery, they never answer a question. It's always rhetoric. It's just this. Like, it drains you so much that you just let them off almost, you know. And you know, but
so if music and art of today could tell a story that one day might be preserved into some kind of mythology, what story would that tell?
I could say that the mythology that would be, that would reflect of what's been happening of this day, it's two forces definitely going head to head, and one wishing complete freedom for all, and the other standing for complete control. And I mean, we never really know enough about the control side. What is this aim, this goal for complete control? What is the reason for this? And clearly, they aren't facing the consequences of previous actions that are kind of manifesting. I mean, they're running away from something clearly. That they can't get away from. It's like they're holding on to everything they can. They're sucking off life, you know, life or beings, getting things off them, because they everything has crumbled for them. And we're not educated about this. If we, you know, you are empowered when you realize what's actually the whole point of this picture, you know, and you begin to realize, well, my part, I have a choice on which way I want to go with this. And, you know, you are a living energy, you know, being, you know, you still have some part to play. And I think it's the mythology, I think, is repeated a few times, but it's always at a different epoch, really, you know, epoch. And it's, again, it's the, I wouldn't like to say the good versus the evil, because that can be quite misleading, you know. But I think those who serve are quite self-serving, versus those who are geared to kind of try and go with the natural laws of creation, and that's as simple and abstract as I could put it. But the music and art, I mean, you have two sides. You have those who are in this act of creation. With creation, who freely play and perform to what's given to them or just comes to them, and in full respect of what's being passed down to them as well. And then you have the monster, which is the music industry, which doesn't understand music or the point of it at all. And they just don't get it. But they seem to feel that they are the custodians to control it and you know.
See, I would say that I think that they do know, because some of the repetition the use of beats and certain pitches and all that, it is very hypnotic and trance-like. It's like, oh, let's just kind of keep them in this kind of lower chakra place all the time.
Absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head there, because it is definitely there definitely are ingredients, without a shadow of a doubt, that kind of keep us in this kind of box, as it were, you know. And they definitely use those elements. But the musicians, the artists who really kind of break past those boundaries, you never will see them supported. You never see them like with the major labels. I have to say, there's two musicians who are alive still today, who are a great inspiration in the Irish tradition, a musician and singer called Liam O'Mwaley and a piper called Paddy Keenan. And they went to a festival, I think it was in Mali. The documentary was called Festival the Desert. And basically all the nomadic tribes assemble, and they're all various different ethnicities, and they're all very different, and their one way of peacekeeping is through this festival, the music sharing, you know. And they hadn't a word of local language with these people, but they mostly sang in Irish, and they performed there the songs they love as well, and they communicated on a level that you'd wish would be like a universal language. And one of the musicians, one of the harpists, he came from I don't know, 40 generations of playing the harp, this type of African harp, I've forgotten the name. But he was saying, if you don't affect people through your music, if you can't bring emotion is a powerful key through communicating. If you can't make them cry, if you can't make them laugh, if you can't make them smile, if you can't make them, with the hair stand up at the back of their neck, you've failed in the whole point of it. You failed in the performance. You have to go back you have to restudy or just try and grasp the real point, purpose of this. And it's a communication that, it's beyond sophisticated, I think. It's, you know, memories are coming through these traditions, you know. Past tragedies and I think a lot of very sad things have happened that can't be forgotten, and we're kind of avoiding them more and more when we kind of, you know, when we view music as just a background noise, you know. It's one of those things that, you know, I just boggles me when people turn around and say music is just background noise. Well, that's what you might hear, but if you search, There is material that will just...
Then that's when you say, then what you're listening to sucks.
yeah, exactly, you know. Like, clearly, you know. But I mean, like, as Jung says, you know, I think you can get it through, you know, there's art that I don't like simply because there's something about it that just doesn't speak to me. And like, sometimes it is just a pure opinion. But when it's speaking to you on a level that really is speaking to you and is trying to remind you of really where you're going, and that you had agreed to something that you have to fulfill. I mean, you have to develop, you know, you have to develop the things that you need to develop. And as Jung has said, like, what we need is the development of the inner spiritual man, the unique individual whose treasure is hidden in the symbols of our mythological tradition and in man's unconscious psyche. You know, like, these things are, you can't walk away from it. And like, all the technology advancements that are coming are not solving the problems of the world. You know, they're not solving our deepest problems.
It's just masking everything.
Yeah.
Before it explodes or implodes.
Yeah. It's just going to spontaneously combust.
And I'll be glad when it does.
I mean, I think it should make people, I think the bells are ringing, and they're going to be ringing louder, and it's going to be very hard for people not to kind of kind of look at it, you know. And I mean, it's, again, I find you're going to find your own answers that you need to find. If you want to search, you'll find it. You know, it's all up to yourself. And if people don't want to pay attention to it, that's their choice. And you have to respect it. But they also have to respect your choice. And this is the thing, you find one way where, you know, we have to acknowledge those who just insist, no, I don't want any part of that. And you go, that's fine. But you have to be respected as well, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I don't see. I don't see this, you know, kind of consideration for others who are just of a different opinion, you know.
Yeah, I definitely see that in this field too, even amongst alternative research. It's like, where's the kindness and the patience and the compassion? And if someone is off on a specific detail, I'll just send a nice little chatty email and say, hey, by the way, instead of just attacking people.
Yeah. This is when people still go off on they're forgetting it again, you know. It's not about getting one up another person.
That's
and
right.
You know, saying, oh, I know more than you, etc., etc. I mean, it's not about that. It's, you know, we're meant to be all kind of helping each other out here, and that's extremely difficult, you know. But we should at least just listening is that's a talent. It really is shown to be a talent, because so few do listen, you know. And being as open-minded as possible, and not, you know, it is hard when something, you know, finding information that you'd never heard about before, and it blows you away so much that you go, this is the gospel of the knowledge, like, this is what it's all about. And then not that shortly afterwards, something else bombards you and you go, my God, whoa. And you have to keep being open to the possibilities, to all of them. And I do think there's truths in all of them. You just have to, it's like assembling it all and kind of where trying to make it, getting more perspective on it, you know.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
Because we are it's easy for us to be all led astray in the mayhem of it, in the chaos, you know, and just not pausing for those split seconds going, hold on a minute. I mean, there are so many kind of consorts. There's so many things that are trying to. There are lots of counterparts that are trying to get us off what we need to be going to. You know,
that's why I think in this time it's kind of key to listen to the spirit of truth. That's kind of the time that we've moved into. You have to feel it. You have to use that gut feeling, opposed to your brain. You know.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. It's following that inner voice, that gut feeling again, and that you are, you know, you do have that connection to all of this. I mean, never let some medium, some person that get in the way of that deep connection that you already have, that you have a right to. It's you have a direct line, you know, and don't forget it. You're going to have influences that might necessarily be on this level that obviously will want to feed off you in a way. I mean, opening up your heart, but be tough. Make sure it's tough love. Discern what you're opening yourself up to. It's a tough one, but you can't be naive when you're in this area as well of research, because, you know, there are things that will prey on you, and it's like looking back on past relationships and when you thought something was what it was, it wasn't, you know, and when you put an image on it that it isn't actually, and then we learn the hard way, but you still come out of it. I mean, I don't think anyone is ever going to be totally thrown off course, but I tell you, it is a total journey. And as Joseph Campbell says, you have to discover your own mythology, you know. That is, you can't follow someone else's mythology. You can't follow the so-called teachers or the gurus who do have their advice, their knowledge to disseminate. But I mean, you can't follow their word all the time. They're making their journey as well. And I mean, you know, take the guidance that you can, but don't forget your own voice as well.
That's right. And become your own archetype, your own original one. You know, I'm sick of hearing about, oh, I'm an incarnation of ISIS. It's like, come on.
It's kind of cool.
Let's move on.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there are many, well, there's so many though as well. This is another thing that kind of, it boggles me. There are so many types of personalities and archetypes. There's a rich array them. And I think, yeah, this is another thing. They're just the usual ones we always hear about, you know? You know, like Isis, or, you know, you have Zeus and all the pantheon of all the gods and all the cultures, the usual ones we always hear about. But I'm almost fascinated by hearing the names I don't generally come across most, you know, often. And it's just a little interest I have, you know, in checking it out. But like going back to, like looking over the evolution for myself, the journey I've made so far, I have a long way to go. The material that the artwork that I've done mostly on my website, it's for a couple of bands, and it's mostly again doom rock. it's that heavy bass, kind of chunky, slow rhythm sounds. That it's a real lower chakra kind of buzz to it. And but the thing is that the artwork is always changing all the time, and you know, it never, I don't wish to it ever to stay stagnant, you know. It has to keep evolving more and more, and I'm not gonna aim to have a style specifically. The only thing I know is that it's coming out of me somehow, and it is what it is. You know, and I totally embrace everyone else that does their own thing. And competition, this is another thing that stifles some of the most incredible minds and incredible artists. And it drives you. Competition will drive you and stresses you to get to strive to that potential. But the jealousy that comes within the competition actually is the killer, because you forget to embrace that other person's their own expression, which again is part of the whole creation, you know, that's speaking back to you, you know. And that's something that I find with some of the most incredible minds, incredible musicians, artists, etc. That's the biggest fault. It's a crutch, you know what I mean? It just gets in the way, and it's really unnecessary. And
yeah, I think you have to just crush that feeling when you feel it. It does no good.
It does no good. It really does stop. It just stifles the progress, you know. Well, whatever that progress it is, you know. But to kind of bring up, by the way, when it comes to music and archaeology, musical instruments are something that I am really fascinated about. Archaeomusicology is an incredible subject, and hearing about the Neanderthal flute find, it was found in Serbia in a cave, and it was on a bear's femur, and this is a Neanderthal flute that when played, it echoes something that it's happening right now, you know. It's like of this moment. It's completely contemporary, you know. We have this fixed opinion that things in the past were completely, you know, devolved and you know, just unsophisticated and uncreative, you know. Mm-hmm. A very kind of narrow-minded opinion. But when you look at the material that happily has survived, because the stuff that hasn't survived that did exist, we can't even bring up because they say it didn't exist, you know. But it's the stuff that is there staring in our faces, again, is another kind of message of the development or the human story of where we've come to now. And it kind of might echo some of the research people are trying to bring to the foreground of the calamities or the changes or these, you know, what really happened, what did really go on then, you know, and what has shaped to where we are now. And you know, that's what I find really fascinating when we look at some of this material.
One last question for you. I just wanted to get your take on 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar.
Yeah, when I first heard about it, it's, you know, it's one of those things that, of course, I want to know a lot more about it. I mean, it was just really interesting. It's more than interesting. I felt, wow, this is something that this we're all part of this, you know, so I have to check this out. And my own personal opinion on it would be that without a shadow of a doubt, there's definitely going to be massive changes. But it's not what we would assume as they are. I mean, there's just a lot of chaos going on at the moment in most of the countries, particularly within the political area. And what I can just see this, there's a lot of, I can see things falling apart in a way. I think the cards are falling bit by bit. It's a really tough one, Lana, because one part of you thinks I don't know if there's a lot of honesty. I mean, I don't think people are actually lying about what they know. But I mean, I think we're getting bombarded left, right, and center, and we're being put off track big time on what possibly could be happening. And there's many outcomes.
But any specific feelings you have?
I'm wary, actually. I'm actually quite wary. I don't believe it's going to be this big, massive kind of the Earth rotating in a massive scale or anything. But I could see changes. I mean, it has been said that the sun is acting up quite a lot. And, you know, if it's a case that the sun might be soon dying, well, I can't see much life on the Earth, you know. I think a lot of animals will want to reincarnate or get the hell out of here. You know, I don't think anyone will be along or will be around here for much longer if that is the case. But the 2012 phenomenon, it's right now it's left me really baffled. And I was thinking about it so much a couple of years back that I haven't been thinking about it at all.
Now that we're actually in 2012. And I wonder if after the year goes by, everyone's just going to be kind of about it, you know.
You know, it's mad because you asked me something I actually haven't thought about in a while. Because I mean, steeped up in all this other stuff that I'm going, wow, Jane, this is great stuff, you know.
Hey, no worries. None of us have all the answers.
you could definitely sense that there's, I wouldn't discredit that every couple of thousand years something, the gates are opening or they're closing. And that's why there's some race to get something done, whatever that is, and whoever it is. Those who are of the, again, self-serving nature, who have control or whatever they wanted at their fingertips, are possibly really scrambling. Because the thing is, most of us have nothing. And most of us have nothing really to lose, because some of us don't really have much anyway. You know, I mean, if you have the ideas in your head and what you just enjoy and love around you, and I mean, that always will continue on. That will linger on no matter what. But those who have these just fixation on material things and have all this, you know, they are slaves actually themselves, because they've put themselves in a situation. They've detached themselves from. They've become completely detached, I think, for what really, you know, what's on the cards. I can't see the Earth. I mean, the Earth can shake us all off like flies if it wishes to, you know. And it is meant to have been here to get us through things that we were meant to. Our goal was to kind of understand or learn, and clearly things have been hijacked. Mm-hmm. Because nothing makes bloody sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you're here for how many years? You wake up and you're here and you're told this is how it is. And there's always a problem left, right and center. And nothing seems to work properly. And, you know, things should be just like that. You should be able to get things done without any hesitation, you know. But yet, no, it doesn't work like that at all. And someone says, that's just life. No, it's not just life. You know, you have to kind of looking at it is that things are not full of chaos all the time. You know, there should be a natural order to things.
Well, let's face it, and most governments are part of all of the chaos. They create all the chaos.
Yeah, it's exactly the lie that they keep kind of making another lie to kind of protect that lie that they lied before that lie, you know. It's unbelievable. But, I mean, what we as ordinary divine, beautiful people should realize is that meditating on the visions that you wish to see around you, or, you know, you can create what you wish around you. You know, you just have, we've been conditioned to a degree that we can't, we're incapable of that. So they can use all of the type of keys they want through the symbols and all of that to sell their products, you know, and such and such. But we don't have that. We have no access to that. You know, it's clearly a big bully tactic that's going on. And, you know, bullies are the worst because they're the most scared. That's why they're acting the way they are. And they just can't, they're just complete. And it's not even a personal thing, actually. That's the thing. It's totally impersonal. They don't care. They just do what they wish to do because that's how they see it is. They're like really struggling just to keep up going, you know.
Well, maybe they are hybrids, who knows.
yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, and as well as that, going back to you know, within metal music you do tip on aspects of the occult, and it's a club, I suppose, that I'm not invited to. You know, all these kind of clubs that if you're excluded, you can sniff that out for yourself and realize, okay, something's up here. You know, if you have to pay allegiance to someone like that, something like that, you know, something's up. And, you know, like I remember, for example, Geezer Butler, the bassist from Black Sabbath, he, in the earlier days, he was dabbling, as he said, with the occult. And this is an innocent kind of, you know, curiosity that's kind of getting into areas that you have to be a bit more aware of, be more cautious of. And yeah, he said he had dabbled with the Ouija board maybe for a bit. And he woke up one morning and he saw the shadowy figure at the end of his bed. Now, whatever it was like, state your allegiance or fuck off. That was the kind of message.
Jeez.
He kind of thought. Yeah, quite direct, you know. Honestly, direct. But it was his attitude was, he's like, I'm getting out of this. I'm not messing with this stuff anymore. You know, there's a price you pay.
Yeah, there's good and bad everywhere on every level.
Yeah, definitely. And but I could sense. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, it is there, and I think a lot of people, particularly that are into, it's become really fashionable, occult rock. And I mean, it was always there anyway, but it's become really particularly fashionable now. And it's not a trendy thing. You know, you don't wear it around your neck. Like, you know, in Topshop or, you know, Oasis having these nice little necklaces that are like totems, or, you know, little kind of, you know, little aspects that they think are quite fashionable and cool. But, I mean, you know, you don't know really what's behind it. And, for example, it goes back to codes and symbols. Yes, you see the pentagram splashed around a lot within, you know, between pagan circles and in, you know, occult rock. And the pentagram is it's a pretty old symbol that's been used there. And, you know, and for whatever use it's attached with, you know, you kind of have to question, well, yes, that is a sacred old symbol. So what is it attached to here? Well, like, what product are they putting it on for us to kind of get drawn into? It's a magnet almost. And I mean, it is, you know, I have no doubt about it. I think it is a sexual kind of code magnet. And no wonder, like, you see that kind of flaunted with, it dabbled in the kind of satanic kind of fashionable circles, you know, and or pagan. You know, it is a very kind of, you could say, sacred code, but if it's being misused, you know, you have to kind of peek up your ears, without me being too vague and maybe annoying some people by saying that, but that's just how it is. You know, it's, you just have to be more aware of what you're looking at. And I mean, some of these symbols that are overly used, not for good anyway. You know, the symbol itself isn't bad. It's just what it's used for, you know, because they're definitely using it as a magnet. They're drawing you in, and they know that. But again, I don't think some of the bands such, you know, are looking at it like that, you know. But you kind of have to, it's a curious one, you know.
Well, why don't you give out your website so everyone can go check out your art?
Yes, right. Well, my current website at the moment is on www.wix.com/Elaine C/Sgraffito. That's Sgraffito. And I will be updating it over the next month or two, and there will be more material up, and more canvas pieces. At the moment, it's artworks straight from 2006 up to 2010. So it's only been 4 years' work, but I have more material that I'm going to be putting up there. And yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It's always a blast talking with you.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Lana. Thank you so much. Again, go to Mila Mila Malgut. A thousand thanks your way and to all the listeners that given their time just to listen to me waffle on, you know. So, yeah, it's been a real privilege and an honour to be on. So thank you so much and wish the best of luck.
We're going to leave you today with one of Elaine's favourite songs by Black Sabbath called Spiral Architect. Take it easy.
That I should.